I'm Peter Ayers, and you're listening to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives.
Correct. Oh, we started now. Yes.
Yes, of course we've started.
I'd been working at the Playbox Theatre, and I'd worked as an ASM on a show, a Louis Nara show, The Golden Age.
The golden years of Hollywood. That was what I loved.
Absolutely don't profess to be good at it at all. I could study and I could be much more diligent in my homework.
So in a sense, you know, I think really good directors are really good editors.
I was really incapable of going on, not just as a writer, but I felt as if I was incapable of going on as a human.
One more day before the storm. And Trevor says, stop. He said, you look like little Lord Fauntleroy, dip the wig.
So I swooped in and just... Every scene I had with all those different people, they just made it work.
But after some time, I realised that grey comes in many, many hues.
I've had the luck, and without the luck, I know plenty of entertainers out there that are wonderful, funny, just never had the breaks.
I'm what I would call a dancer's dancer. Like, all I ever wanted to do was dance.
You've got a better memory than me, that's for sure.
Oh, I've done my research. I've cheated.
And you'd had a little piece of paper there, mind you, so have I.
We both had pieces of paper, so that's been
alright. I wasn't silly, was I?
No, I think it was great. Yeah. Thank you, Sheila.
Thank you, Peter. God bless.
Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and welcome to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives about craft and career. Judith Hoddenott has made considerable impact as an educator and a theatre designer across all disciplines. Training at the University of New England and the National Institute of Dramatic Arts, her design work has been seen complementing a myriad of stages for theatre companies around Australia. I'm thrilled that Judith is my guest today on Stages. She offers an abundant knowledge on the processes of design and reflection on guiding the artists of the future through her role as teacher. Hoddy, lovely to see you and catch up with you in this episode of Stages.
Oh, thank you very much. It's lovely seeing you, Peter.
We of course know each other as educators, but of
we
course
do.
You had a life before then. You started your professional career as a designer for the theatre.
I did, as you had a professional career, a big career before being an educator. And I think, you know, it's much more the way things are now that people during their lifetime have several professions. And I think it's great because each enrich the other. And I think I'm very, very pleased that I have had, I was a designer when I was younger, dare I use that word, and because I had massive energy for it and a passion for it. But I'm also very, very pleased that I came to teaching later, just in the way that I guess I had a view of the world that I hoped I can enrich my students with. So, yeah, I've loved having two careers.
Yeah. Indeed, some people have many more than that.
I know.
When I was starting out, people did say, oh, don't worry, you'll have a few careers through your life.
I know, but I always saw that as a slightly veiled criticism, like, yeah, you're not going to make it in this one, doll, so you better get over it. But I know, and really, when I retire from teaching, I hope that I do have another interest that I pursue or a career that I go into on my Zimmer frame or whatever. But I do. I think it keeps you vital. It keeps you interested.
I had a brief foray into protocol with the Sydney Olympics in 2000.
God, did you?
Yeah. I worked facilitating the Olympic family through the airport process. So, and
oh, wow.
I loved that. Yeah, that was about a year of
talk about that time as a really a wonderful time. And I just remember being a spectator in Sydney. It was, you know, the city came alive and you felt like a tourist in your own city, which was great.
Were you involved at all creatively, or were you teaching by then? Were the kids involved? Because there was a huge cast in the opening and closing.
No, so what year was it? That was
2000.
2000 was the year I did Shout. So it was, I was absorbed in my own career, really, and doing, you know, big flashy things. But the person I was co-designing with, who of course was Michael Scott Mitchell, he was up to his eyeballs in doing cauldrons and God knows what. So I felt sort of we lived through the design experience via Michael, really. Yeah.
Shout, the musical about JF not JFK,
J-O-K. J-O-K, yes, yeah. Our own J-O-K. Yeah, that was wonderful. And why it was wonderful primarily was it was working with Richard Werrett, who was, I guess, one of my favourite directors I worked with. I only worked with him twice, but just what a man and what great humanity he had. He was very ill at the time of directing this.
I think that was his last show.
It was his last show. And despite that, there was never a sense of poor me or, you know, it's all about me. There was always a sense of we're doing this together and we're this great little creative team. And also we are supporting David Campbell, whose shoulders that show was resting on. And he was a young man. He'd done quite a bit, but he'd never been this. So Richard Werrett was always about all of us as a community, but also us supporting each other, but us also, you know, doing our very best work. There was nothing ever that he would have accepted that was slipshod or ill-conceived or whatever. So, yeah, he was a great person and sorely missed by, I think, a lot of people out, you know, in theatre.
Using David Campbell as a segue, I see that you also designed Only Heaven Knows.
I did.
Was that the production with David or the very first
that
production?
That was the very first one at production. And Only Heaven Knows was, who wrote it? I can't remember, but it was the first production of it, and it was on at the Griffin.
Was it Campion Descent? No.
No, I can't even remember. But it was directed by Margaret Davis, but the writer was in there, and he was from London, and he was living in Australia. I think his partner died of AIDS. One of the first people who had died of AIDS that I knew. And he did that, Only Heaven Knows, at the Griffin Theatre, and it was, we just absolute loved doing it. It was on The Smell of an Oily Rag.
Alex Harding,
he was lovely. Darling Alex Harding. And he, what was great about doing that show, well, it was one of the first, I guess, shows about being gay, and it was also about that he wanted all stops and whistles. We had $2.50 basically, but what we did with that and how we celebrated Sydney and the reviews that we got were incredible. We just had a wonderful time on it, and he was an inspiration because he'd done all this stuff back in the UK, quite diverse and sort of subversive theatre. Yeah, and I remember going to his tiny weeny little terrace in Surrey Hills, said some of these may be useful, and he opened up this trunk that was incredibly musty with these dreadful old bits of campus costumes you've ever seen in your life that were disintegrating, and we took bits of that and we created this world, which was wonderful.
A seminal work in Australian theatre too, because it was, as you say, one of the first. There had been several
there
before,
had been. Yeah,
but
yes.
Representing gay life, gay cultures. Yeah.
And also, you know, drag queens and this young boy comes to the coming out age play, comes to the city, cannot believe what he sees and falls in love. And this story that is, it's just a beautiful story, but it's also got a real political agenda, and it definitely did for Alex. And that's what he was about. That was his thing in life, was to comment, make things a social comment, but a joy to work with.
A different size canvas that you're designing for with a show like Only Heaven Knows, which was done at the Griffin?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
That funny little, corner stage that we put a scrim across. It had a band, weirdly, you know, two men and a dog, and it had neon and it had whatever, and it was before the renovation. So sometimes we forget that, you know, the Griffin that we have now, which was so much more sophisticated than that, and the Griffin that we're going to get, which will be another stage again. But the one that we had then, I think they had to have a jar in the dressing room so they could have a pee, because they couldn't go downstairs. You'd break that illusion. So it was fun, but it was Yeah, it was boiling hot, and there were many restrictions to it. But my job, of course, as the designer, was to make those restrictions an advantage, mm-hmm. and I love doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that show compared to something like Shout, which is on a large canvas. Yes. You're in the Capitol Theatre, I think, for
You betcha.
For Shout.
Yeah.
Is it easier designing the big picture or smaller picture, or you just take each gig as it comes?
You take each gig as it comes. I didn't do the set, of course, for Shout. That was Michael, and he made it like the original boxing venue that JOK first performed in, and it was bright blue. So my job was to create those worlds, at a heightened world, but all had to pop in front of that blue. So oranges and pinks and greens and all that sort of thing. So it was enormous fun. But it that is a logistical problem rather than a creative problem, getting all those, you know, short, quick changes and whatever. But it was an imaginative highlight of my career, I think, just because I was working with such great people. I had Michael and I had Richard, and Trudy Dalgleish did the lighting, and we'd been at NIDA together, Trudy and I. And so it was a really satisfying and sort of invigorating thing. And we got to go, you know, open it in Melbourne, and our families were together. Michael at that stage had two little kids. I had two bigger kids, and it was just a wonderful thing.
Yeah. I remember all those wonderful colours that just popped in that show. But it's a period that we remember or that we think about in black and white.
I know. Isn't it amazing? Yeah. And yet, a lot of the most colourised things, if we think about it, have been things from the 50s. If we think of, Pleasantville and all that sort of world that's created, we do also think of it as in saturated colour, because I guess they colourise things. So, you know.
The great Coco Chanel, who was a fashion designer, but she said, before you leave the house, look in the mirror and remove one accessory.
Yes.
Can a costume be over-designed?
Yes, it can. Yeah. But I do think I come from the era of, you know, pull it back, whereas wonderful Catherine Martin, I think, has liberated design because she doesn't believe you need to take a thing off. In fact, I think she would think, put something else on to make it a bit more zappy and make it edgy and subversive. So there are trends in design, and I realise very much that I'm a product of pull it back, whereas I just loved Elvis. I just remember Strictly Ballroom and thinking, what a breath of fresh air all that approach to the visual was with her and Baz. You know, they just love all that sort of over design, but it's not over design. It's creating a beautiful, beautiful world. Yeah.
What was the first costume design that you created? Do you remember?
That I created out of NIDA. Well, I did one as a secondment when I was in NIDA, for a show for Marion Street called In Duty Bound, and it's all about this Jewish boy who falls in love with a non-Jewish girl. Nicholas Eady played the Jewish boy. And I remember designing a wardrobe of costumes for the mother who was trying to stop her son marrying out. And I remember basing it on my mother-in-law and that whole sort of heightened, matriarchal sort of look. And I remember that being one of the first designs that was actually criticised, as in, you know, it was given a critique and a favourable critique. And I remember thinking, yeah, I do love this, because good design is about observation as well as creativity. It's about, oh, that's the type of watch he wears, or, oh my goodness, I can tell just from looking at that person that I'm going to find them quite an interesting person because of the creative choices that they've made. So, yeah, I understand Coco Chanel, though, yeah. Yeah, she was fairly, she had a great eye, didn't she?
Our conversation, I'm sure, is going to cross between the classroom and the rehearsal room.
Yeah,
So let's talk about the education of the arts also. and a question which I expect I know the answer of.
Yes.
Is it STEM or STEAM should it be?
It should be STEAM.
Yeah, of course.
Yes.
The arts should be in there,
yes,
shouldn't they?
Yeah. They invigorate everything. They make our students confident. They make them think about themselves in a big, big picture way, not just in the subject way. They see themselves as this person who has this valid opinion and can be quite adept at communicating that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And all children who experience a participation in the performing arts at school,
yes,
they're not necessarily going to be designers or actors. Or
no, not
but
at
but
all.
That experience is going to enhance their humanity.
Absolutely. Yeah. And my niece stayed the other day, and she's in this group called Pollination. She's one of the, you know, she's just got a promotion. She's amazing. But one of the people that she works with was one of the drama students when I first started at Newtown. And what it's given him, and he will talk about this to Olivia all the time, is that it made him confident. You know, he went and did other things with it. I don't often expect the people that I'm talking to in my classroom to actually become actors or whatever. I've just wanted them to see different viewpoints, or when they do embark on their career, that they're confident and they're good communicators. And, of course, as you know, Pete, a major skill is that they're collaborative,
yeah,
that they can, yeah, you know, that is a major thing. And apparently employers are looking for it more and more,
yeah,
you know, rather than they have been just specialised so early and sort of pruned their interests rather than expanded them. I think expansion is always the way to go.
Mm.
Yeah.
And part of our gig as drama teachers is always mounting the school production,
yeah,
whether it be a musical or a play.
Yes.
And I constantly remind my team when things are getting a little bit, you know...
Heated.
You're at the pointy end, everyone's a bit tired, etc.
Yes.
That we have this wonderful responsibility and gift that we're creating memories and experiences for those kids that they will hang on to
a
lifetime. They'll always remember when they were Eliza in My Fair Lady or the second spear carrier from the left in Julius Caesar.
Exactly. And other things evaporate. Yeah. But in their mind, maybe because they felt maybe they should have been the lead or whatever, or that you made them feel that they were seen and that they were important and that they were part of something, that, you know, they had a great first night party or whatever. But also that because as you know, if you're doing a musical or a play, you meet constantly and you meet regularly and you see them more than you would your the other students that you're teaching, that so you bond as a little family, just like we did in those productions that we did before we went into teaching. You have those close relationships that you do remember forever, and hopefully you keep for the rest of your life.
And final night when all the tears...
Oh, my God. Yes. The tears. Will we ever see each other again? We are so much best buddies, etc., etc. Those show romances, God almighty.
What were your shows at school that you remember?
Well, I just went to a very regular high school, Armidale High, but I remember the geography teacher. His name was Gus Plater, and he was a great, strong unionist too. He would put on... the GNS. So we would have, I remember in the Gondoliers, I was chorus member, I think very, very ordinary. But it was great fun. It was great fun. And I guess it was one of the first times I thought, no, this costume will not do. I am not that person. And so, you know, I became very aware of how important costuming was. But they were great experiences, yeah. And also, I guess also seeing teachers go at the extra 5 or 10 yards or whatever to make students have a good experience, and that school is a rich experience, is so important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So growing up in rural New South Wales?
Yeah. Old Armidale, yes.
Yeah, yeah. What were the artistic opportunities there for your personal expression or for actually seeing
stuff? Well, my parents were academics in the English department, and I think my father came from England and my mother came from Tasmania. They met at Oxford University, so they were very, very much about us seeing theatre. So we would regularly go to Sydney Just the family, just off we go. And we saw things like Peter Brook's Midsummer Night's Dream. We would have regular sabbaticals. So every 7 years we'd live in England. So we saw David Hockney's Rake's Progress. So we were very lucky in that it was a priority of our parents. So we would always be seeing theatre. And a lot of the most heated and passionate discussions we would have was, for God's sake, why in the hell did they interpret Taming of a Shrew like that or whatever? And I remember when I was at NIDA being incredibly embarrassed by my parents when they went to see A Twelfth Night that John Clarke had directed, and he'd set it in the time of the Raj. Hugo Weaving was in it as, what was he in it? Sir whatever. And my father saying, this was an outrageous, ridiculous interpretation that just totally disregarded racial issues. And so it was a passion that the family had, and so they were thrilled when I actually decided to actually pursue it. And they were the greatest sort of, well, my father died early, but my mother definitely supported me in my career and thought that it was a great thing to do.
Had you entertained any other vocations growing up?
Well, I did a BA Dip Ed at the end. Yes, I did. I wanted to be an artist. And I applied straight out of school to Sydney College of the Arts. I think that's what it was called. I can't remember. And I got into being a jeweller. So I could, and my mother said, no, well, you may want to be to that, but you'll have to wait because we're putting Anne, my older sister, through law in Sydney. So you'll have to wait till she's finished that, and then we'll pay for this degree if you still want to be a jeweller. Thank God I didn't. that might have been not such a great option. But, so I didn't really. And then I did, teacher education scholarships were available, and I got one with a very mediocre HSC result. And so I took it up, and I actually found I loved doing it. But by the end of my degree, Dip Ed, it was non-bonded at those times, I decided, no, I didn't. I actually had loved doing drama at university, and that's where I wanted to go. And I applied, and I got into NIDA. And so, you know, I'm constantly amazed and grateful that I did, because that really shaped my life. And it was a great opportunity, and I just loved every minute of that course that I did.
The design course was quite young, I imagine. At that point,
I think it was. I don't know. I imagine it was. I know Peter Cook's year was the first year of the designers, so I guess we came a decade after that. So it was new, and it did have a few glitches in it. But the fundamental thing about it is that you go to opera all the time, you go to theatre all the time. The conversations you're having with the person on the drawing board next to you are all about that world. So after 3 years, you're pretty much really educated in what it is to be a designer, and you're passionate about it, and you're committed to doing it because it is a passion, a definite passion. So that was wonderful.
What was the entry audition like for you? Well, what did you have to do?
We had a portfolio,
right.
And I brought everything, the kitchen sink as well. And I remember the exhausted people after I'd shown them yet another mask that I'd made out of paper mache, or another bit of, you know, student drama, said, well, thank you for showing such an extensive portfolio. When I think of now the ones that you see online of these designers, I think of the roughness of all that. But I guess what they saw was a general enthusiasm and an ability to be shaped, rather than I was a product that they wanted to, you know, that I was ready to go. I was not at all ready to go. I was needing that education massively.
Who was the faculty teaching you and guiding you?
Alan Leese was the head, and he had done a huge amount of opera, and Axel Bartz, and I think there was a student on that desk there. It was a blistering day. It would have been 40 degrees, and we had to, as the audition, also do a model and a set of costume drawings. As I saw my poor little model warp in the sun, and the scale, I'm sure, was appalling, I thought, here we go. What the hell? But anyway, it was in the old tote building, so it was not air conditioned, and we were, you know, pouring sweat. But it was, yeah, it was a great process, you know. And we did, I did Royal Hunt of the Sun. That was the play that was there that you designed to show them that you had the capacity to research and to have an imaginative take on that world.
And then working on other great texts while you're studying, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
I know.
The Provoked Wife. Yes. Kennedy's Children, Buried Child.
Yes.
Yeah.
I designed Buried Child as my graduation piece with Kevin Jackson, was my director, and I absolutely loved it. And it was... it was great because it was part of a repertoire of three plays. So it had to be struck by some poor technical students within a few hours. So you needed to work out how to abbreviate or stylize that landscape. And I loved doing that production. It was, and I, being a teacher at UTS as I was, I put that up as a text that we designed, and I also put it up as a design text with HSC, because it is such a rich and beautiful world, and Sam Shepherd's writing is so, so wonderful. I just think it's such a great, great piece. And then I did Midsummer Night's Dream with Reese McConaughey, which I loved too, as my two graduating texts. And we set it as the whole thing was a dream. And I was very lucky with the directors I got to work with in my graduating years, because they were such great communicators, and so they trusted me too, which I couldn't believe. Who would have thought that I would be trusted? but also went with me, and I went with what they were doing. So it was Reese's idea that the whole thing was a dream. Okay, how do we do it? And then I found this Paul Poiret painting on a bedroom wall of a blossom tree losing its blossoms, and so that suggested the world that we went into, and everyone wore nightwear, and wonderful Paul Goddard was bottom. He was just adorable. It was great because it gave me that world, and now I need to make the choices within that world. Yeah, and Mona Sirius, she was wonderful as Titania. Yes. Anyway, yeah, it was a great experience.
Who were the designers working in the industry at that time that you looked up to?
The one we worshipped was Brian Thompson. Because what he did was he looked at art, pop art particularly, and from that he created these marvellous worlds. And I remember going on we used to get free tickets, and we were usually a sneery bunch that used to think, oh my God, I could do better. But I remember we went to his Chinchilla, the play about Diaghilev, and there it was, this white box. And I just thought, and it had a ballet bar encircling it. And the costumes by, I think it was Terry Ryan, walked across it. And it was that beautiful Belle Epoque. And I think that was something that for our year of NIDA, the designers, that really shaped us. We thought that is just such beautiful, careful design. And Peter Carroll, I think, was Diaghilev, was it? Yes, I think so. And Peter Cousins was in it. And probably someone like Jane Hardis, I'm not sure. I can't remember, but all I do remember was just coming out of it and thinking, you know, if ever I could design anything as beautiful as that, I will be incredibly happy.
Was it daunting graduating? Because you're going into an industry where there's less work for designers than there is for actors, really. Yes. And there's not a lot of work for actors.
Yeah. Well, it actually, strangely enough, it wasn't like it is now, where people are going into film and also seeing their careers, out of Australia. We didn't at all. We saw, Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney, maybe Brisbane. But there were those little companies like the Q and Hunter Valley Theatre Company, and a lot of things like that were marvellous, because we could actually get our first gigs there, and we could work with a budget. We weren't in the limelight, so we could be making mistakes as well as making creative, risky decisions. And often those heads of those companies were incredibly kind and helpful and wanted us to succeed and felt that they were lucky to get us. So we had, you know, Brent McGregor was up at Hunter Valley, out at the queue, I think it was Doreen Warburton, and then Helmut Begaitis took that over, and places like that. So they really, and I also remember New Moon Theatre Company, I had a gig there, and that was in Rockhampton at the time. But it was places that you really were very welcoming to you, and that you could also do this wonderful work. And then you had a bit of a portfolio to go to Sydney Theatre Company or to whoever, or Opera Australia, or so you could, you know, then have some work behind you, and you could feel more confident, I think. So it was daunting, though. And I remember when I graduated and I was out of that little pool of our studio where there were the five of us sort of working away, I did feel like this is overwhelming. But finally, you know, you get back on your feet, or someone tells you there's a job going or whatever. You have a little network. So that was great.
Was there an agent that represented designers, or are you effectively now a small business and you're handling your own?
Well, they didn't do, I don't think, what they do now at NIDA, which is NIDA's designers are looked after. I didn't have a I didn't have an agent for a long time, and then I only had that agent for a short amount of time because I actually generated my own work. But there was, I think Hilary Lindstedt, she was the one that represented them. I think that was she was the one everybody wanted. Right. Yeah.
Judith, talk me through the process of design, because, you know, somebody says to you, we're doing Romeo and Juliet, we'd love you to design the costumes.
Yeah.
You obviously read the play.
Oh, yeah. You read the play, you have some idea of what, you know, I mean, Romeo and Juliet is open slather. So you need, first of all, to talk to your director. They may have a set idea, but they may not. So once you've talked with them, that shapes where you go. And if, say, I've met, you know, this director and they want to do it, set it in, you know, Verona in the 1650s, God forbid, I would then, what you do is you go and then research. And what is amazing now, and people forget, and I guess it shows that I'm old, is that we didn't have the internet. So you'd go to the State Library, or you'd go to you'd go to various libraries, or you'd talk to your friends who had art books, or you'd immerse yourself in the art, probably is your safest option. And also you'd be shaped by the venue, your budget, your actors. So say if I was designing Romeo and Juliet, and in those days Ruth Cracknell was playing Lady Capulet, probably I would involve her in the design process once I'm along a certain way, because I'd show her what she's wearing and I would try to include her in the whole piece. But you go and you research, you start making choices depending on their status, their age, what side of they're on, the Capulet or a Montague. And with something as wonderful as Romeo and Juliet, you've got those two teams. You've got the Montagues and the Capulets. And if you're a Cluey designer, you would give them a particular look. So that fantastic Romeo and Juliet with Catherine Martin designed it. Was it Angus? Did he design the costumes? They've decided there's one that's very sort of black and you know, Cuban heels, and that's the look. And then the other one is Hawaiian shirts, you know, the Montagues, I think they were the Hawaiian shirts, and the sort of Venice Beach look. And so what you're doing as a designer is you're creating two worlds. So even a very un-theatre literate audience could come in and see, we've got opposing teams. This is what these guys represent. This is what these guys represent. And you start walking the audience through it. And yeah, that's how you design. You meet, you research, you have your first set of sketches, Then you have, oh no, I don't like this. You have your second set of sketches. You have your final sketches. This is just costume I'm talking about. And you create the world. And if you are in charge of it all, like you're doing the set and costume, you're in charge of, okay, this is the world I'm doing. This is the architectural style. These are the changes in atmosphere and mood that I want to create. This is the budget I have. And if you're working as a team with a set designer, because I would usually be a costume designer, I would never be set and someone else doing costume, then you work hand in glove with them and you create the world. So it is either highly stylized or very real and very truthful, and you work that out pretty early on.
There's a conversation with the lighting designer also, imagine, because depending on the lights they throw on the costumes,
they can make you
read
or break
very
you.
Differently.
Yeah. And one of the best lighting designers I've ever worked with is, of course, Nick Schlieper, and he would ask for fabric swatches. And so then he would say, we did, what is that play? Was it an Edward Albee play? I forget what it was called. And Michael Scott Mitchell was the set designer.
The Delicate Balance,
yes. With lovely
beautiful play.
Dinah Shearing. I love that woman. And so Michael had chosen a strong palette for the set. And so therefore I was working with that. But I wanted to create a very American look, a Nancy Reagan look, you know, the little jackets, the sort of imitation Chanel suits, the very sort of stitched up, but very upper middle class world. And so I created that world, but Nick would be definitely, I would say, these are the things I'm thinking, this pink, but each of them had a journey. So the director for that was Simon Phillips. So he's a very visual person and he does beautiful drawings, so very intimidating. But we went for the colours slowly getting colder and colder. So we started with reds and pinks and all that. Then we went into greens. And then finally, when the world splits open, the set was quite blue, so we went into colder colours for that. But that was a lovely direction that he gave me, because it gave me something really interesting to work with.
And that's a very subtle way of telling the story as well, that
the
audience don't fully realise.
Oh,
it's just creeping up on us.
And at the end, that last image, which is all those icy colours, you know, it really, really, you know, you're contacting the audience on a very emotional and subliminal level, because they realise all that warmth has come out of the world. How have they done that? And that's how we did it. And of course with Nick, where he's having to complement all that, and he loves to put lights into the architecture of the set too. So we had a floating ceiling, which can be terribly hard to light, but he made it a massive advantage, and it looked beautiful. Yeah.
Sometimes it's not always possible to access the performers, but you need to also a consideration, I guess, is design a costume where the performer is going to be able to actually do their work, whether that be as an actor or a dancer or a singer.
Yes. But also feel, because you leave that production on opening night, fundamentally, that they go out each night in that and feeling that you have served their character. And Dinah Shearing was an excellent person to work with, because she gave you masses of feedback. But once we had arrived at a costume, she sold it. She looked beautiful in it. And, you know, she was quite exquisite. And the way she wore her heels and things like that. And Jane Harders, who was also in that piece, was similar. There was a feeling of elegance in them. And Heather Mitchell was playing the younger character, and she was also very design literate, and she knew how to work a costume and also how to make suggestions, because a lot of that show was made, but a few bits were shopped. And she said, I know this great designer in Paddington, that look that we're going for, let's shop it in there. And we did, and that was a great thing that she sort of brought to the process.
I'm sure as an actor, I always found it exciting, but I'm sure as a designer, it must be exciting but daunting, that first costume fitting, where the actor sees their costumes.
Yes, absolutely. And it's not only daunting about the actor's response, it's also that how have they cut it? Have they cut it? Have they overfitted it? Or have they underfitted it? Have they, you know, all that sort of thing. What you're worried about is because you're trying to be as diplomatic as possible between the cutter and the actor. So you're not wanting to say, well, they've cut it incorrectly and it's not looking properly. It's not looking as I had envisaged it. You're doing that whole thing. And you're wanting to know, probably sometimes for the first time you're seeing what that measuring sheet looks like in front of you. Oh, I'd misinterpreted. They're quite long in the body, or they don't have a waist. Or so you're wanting them to feel good in it, you know, unless their character is like a caricature and you're wanting them to look like, you know, a buffoon in it. You're wanting them to feel good, to feel enhanced, to feel that they are. And a lot of actors have real triggers about their body. They hate parts of their body, and you really need to have that conversation early on with them about it. Tamsin Carroll, for example, when we did Shout, the first thing she said to me is, oh, I'm long in the body. So, you know, it's weird. You're going to have to compensate about that. And we did, and she looked great. And she worked with us, realizing the quirks of what she, you know, what made her look good and what made her look, well, not sell the line of what we were trying to do. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. You hear about performers all the time knowing what presents them in the best light.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I'm thinking of Marlene Dietrich, who always had to be lit in a certain way.
Oh, my God. And you look at her in some of those films and she just looks absolutely amazing.
Because she knew what worked for her.
Yeah.
Also, these costumes are having to be presented and worn 8 times a week.
Yes.
And something like Shout for a couple of years. So that's a consideration. Also, the materials that you use to...
It is.
Because they need to last, they need to be strong, they need to be laundered regularly.
Yes, and really, the fabrics I veer away from probably are the ones that wear the best. And so I remember making this shirt. I loved this fabric I found for Shout, which was a green and purple, you know, wide stripe in this shirt. It was silk, pure silk. It barely lasted the first season. So it was like, okay, go for the synthetic, even though you hate the drape of it early on because it doesn't drape. You hate this about it, but it will last. And also sometimes when you go off a show like Shout, a lot of those decisions about what replaces the costume is out of your hands. And so you're hoping that the person running wardrobe has an aesthetic. And they don't always. So, and that's not, you know, maybe that shouldn't be their skill base. But so you're wanting that show to last as long as you envisage as possible. So, yeah, fabric choices, I learned the hard way on that one, I must say.
Dimphna Cusack's Morning Sacrifice.
Yes.
Beautiful play.
Yes.
Set in a teaching staff room.
Yes.
All female teachers.
Yes.
You obviously hadn't been teaching at that point. You were still a designer.
I was what we call sessional staff at UTS.
Right.
So that meant that I worked one day and then half a day a week for 12 years at that place. But I hadn't worked in a staff room. I felt very much a sessional staff. I came in, Michael Scott Mitchell and I taught the theatre design course at UTS in the architecture faculty and the interior design faculty. He taught it for a very long time, but I only taught for 12 years. But I actually craved a staff room. I would have loved that collegiality and to be able to discuss things with it. But doing Dimphna Cusack's a play was an interesting thing. I mean, I remember the play Us and Them, came out, it was at Griffin Theatre, my Ned Manning, about the year I came out of NIDA. And I remember seeing it and thinking, wow, that's kind of well observed and interesting. But then going back to this play, Dimphna Cusack, it's also that claustrophobia of all one gender in one staff room and each of them knowing each other but having their petty jealousies or their broken hearts or their whatever, which I find very interesting to do because it's all in the detail of the costume and in those choices that you make about how high is that heel, what is that fabric. And it's also set in the 1940s, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I think so, yeah, in the 1940s. So the period of austerity too, you know, post, you know, when fabrics weren't easy to come by and things like that. So dealing with those parameters, which actually sound as if they're restricting, but they're not at all. Mm-hmm. They're sometimes a wonderful way of you working within those confines to create this landscape of all these weird, different personalities.
You're really investigating the psychology of these characters as well, because how often, depending on how we feel, dictates what we choose from our wardrobe.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And I can teach, we have a course at Newtown called Costume Design, and I say, even within your costume, in your uniform, I can see how you've customized it, so I know about what you are interested in and how you feel about the school, how you feel about yourself, and how you reflect your interests. So yeah, it is. And I'm very aware, being a teacher, what I put on each day, how that reflects what they, how they perceive me, you know. I love clothes.
Designing for opera, does that require a different skill set, or is it still just... I'm just thinking of singers that need to not be restricted. Well, I don't have the diaphragm restricted.
Only, I've only designed one costume, one opera, and I love doing that. But it is.
Il Trovatore.
It does. Il Trovatore with Elka. But what you do, that's a very big learning curve. And I had designed a show before I did Il Trovatore, I think, for the Flying Fruit Fly Circus. And that had so many more restrictions, like if the person is being flown or whatever. So there's a million restrictions. So going into the opera, it wasn't such a terrible thing. And also opera singers, you know, that you design this thing on paper for this sylph-like creature. I know, I remember the direction I had for Manrico from Elka was Antonio Banderas. And then I saw... And then I saw the guy who was playing it, who was adorable, but he was not Antonio Banderas. So the paper, it works on a different level. You have to be endlessly adaptable. And also... You would be a fool not to use the advice of the cutters and the buyers who've been doing it for years, and they say, you've really going to put him in boots to his knees and he's only 5'4"? That's a bit of a stretch. You're going to make him look like a little old weirdo in that. So that you have to use the advice in the room. And I was very, very lucky with the advice I got. It was first put on in Adelaide, and they're a marvellous team. And then, of course, Opera Australia, who took it on because it was part of Opera Conference and refined the whole process with me. And I loved doing that. And also, I loved Elka. Elka was tough, but she had a very clear vision. And it was the Spanish Civil War. And, of course, it was before we had the internet, so you couldn't research it. So going into the library, looking at all this stuff, and just making all those great decisions, looking at that great Hemingway film. What is it? Where Did the Noses Go? What's that film? That beautiful film. Anyway, looking at all that sort of stuff, And then refining those decisions. But you know, her and Elka, with her idea of what is the gypsy in Europe and how to refine that and going there, she was marvellous to work with, if not a little terrifying. Yeah. But she was the director who said, you go to, and she said, this is my vision. And you think, yes, okay, what did they wear? What was Franco's soldiers like? What were people wearing who were the resistance? And it immediately gives you a huge world, and then it is about you selecting it and massaging it and making it real. So that's a world that has to be not stylized, but actually embedded in reality and historical research. Yeah.
Is collaboration always easy?
No, it's not. Well, just talking, then I was just thinking about Elka, and where that was easy at the beginning, but then as directors sometimes become more nervous or more emphatic about things or have seen it differently in their mind's eye, so you're changing things. But if you never lose sight of that, what we're trying to do is to create as the best product and world that we can, you can't go wrong. And you can't feel intimidated or compromised. What you feel is, yes, she's making that decision for a reason. Let's go with it. And you're there to support her. That's the ultimate. You're there to support your director's vision, and you're not about taking the light. Sometimes the best review can be for a costume designer that they don't mention you because you've done such a authentic piece. It's not the review you want, but yeah, I think that collaboration can be difficult, and even with the set designer as well. You feel, are they are those colours or textures or whatever? Is that how I saw it? Or are we walking hand in glove along the path? Or is there some sort of misstep that I've taken or whatever? But fundamentally, conversations heal all that. And just to be an open collaborator and to be, you know, fairly eloquent. You need that.
As drama teachers, we share an experience in delivering in New South Wales the HSC drama course component, yes. the group project, in which students in groups of 3, 4, 5, or 6 need to create an original piece of theatre that runs between 8 and 12 minutes. And that can be a very painful experience, isn't it? Because it requires collaboration. It's something that kids can sometimes, well, adults, we struggle with it at times, but that's why... It is an accessible task because the Board of Studies want those students to develop collaboration.
I think it's an element of the HSC that's constantly under siege, but I totally think it is essential for those students, just as human beings, to negotiate that. Because, you know, I mean, already with my HSC year now, and we're just going into the second term of the course, they're already starting to... Who am I going to be in? What group?
They're very anxious.
I know. And I say, I don't think I have ever had a group that has totally been dysfunctional. But I have had groups that they've wanted their best friends, and I've accommodated that, and it's been the worst decision I've made, because there isn't that competitiveness, or there isn't that... needing to be accountable, or I don't know what it is, but it just hasn't worked. But the HSC group performance is the absolute ultimate in collaboration and diplomacy, and often diplomacy, especially for your as a teacher, that you're guiding them through that process. Yeah,
and there's no formula for success. It is about, you know, these disparate people can come together at times, and it's about that journey and how it's navigated.
Yes. And some of the most fulfilling ones, artistically fulfilling ones, have been with a bunch of people have thought, I'll put them here to mitigate the potential for disaster. But they've actually come together and actually produced something that is really quite beautiful. Mm. I've also said to students, sometimes we get to trials and I say ditch it, or you say ditch it. Sometimes we get to, and we just keep on going, fumbling along on that process, thinking that we're going somewhere. It turns out we've ended up somewhere else. And by the time that they're on stage with those HSC examiners, there is something great there that they're incredibly proud of. All I want them to do is to be proud of what they've done, and to think that they've done their best and that they've learnt something about each other during the process. I think if they get that, I think they usually feel that drama has been a good experience. Yeah.
Judith, you've obviously had a very successful career as a theatre designer. What pulled you back to the classroom?
I gave myself a time frame. I had children during being a designer, and often I would have to put family holidays on the back burner because I'd got a job or blah, blah, blah. And I just felt it was time for me to stop doing that. And I felt that I had designed with a lot of people I had wanted to work with and that I'd done a lot of things that I'd wanted to do in design. And I didn't want to feel that I was constantly on repeat, like I was going through this experience that I'd had before. So I gave myself the timeline of by 2000. And of course, as fate would have it, that's when I got Shout. And then I got Footloose after that, and then I got heaps of things. So it delayed me getting out of theatre. I had taught in a lot of design schools, and I'd loved it. Plus, my son got into Newtown High School of the Performing Arts. And so I started running little design workshops. And the head of drama came up to me one day and said, "Look, you don't have a dip ed, do you?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "Why don't you do some casual work with us?" And that's how it started. And so my teaching experiences in secondary school has only been Newtown, but I think it was strangely the most perfect fit for me. And I'm pleased that's how I got back into it all. And I didn't teach my son, but because he'd finished by then, and then my other son was doing music there, but he was finishing his time there, so that was no awkward thing there. And I just started to teach there, and I just was amazed. I mean, I'd known it by my children's friends that I'd loved the kids there, and they were quirky, and I got them. But when I started teaching my own HSC classes and my own year sevens and my own whatever, I really felt that I loved the experience. Not every day, nobody loves it every day, but overall, when I came out of the week, I felt I'd made a bit of a difference. That's what it's about, I think. I'd made kids see things in a different way, and also they teach you. The best teacher that you get are your own students, and they taught me to be patient. They taught me to moderate expectation, but they also ironically taught me to push my expectations forward. And I also, sometimes my greatest relationships with students are ones that we've had sort of a gnarly sort of beginning, but we've got to appreciate and really understand each other a lot more. And I when I look back on a lot of my students that I've taught, I just feel an incredible fondness for them, that they are lovely, lovely people. And I don't, if they have gone into theatre, I'm immensely proud of them. But a lot of the ones that I feel a great affection for are ones that we just had a moment or an experience, or that we looked at each other in some ways, like, get that person or whatever. And we realised that we had a similar way of looking at the world. And I love that about students. And to work with young people at this pivotal part of their lives, I think is so important, you know. And I think far too many people whinge about teachers when they actually should be thinking, those people are shaping my child and loving my child, and we're here on this journey together. And and I'm very proud of being a teacher. When I hear all this bad press and people think, oh God, so after being a designer, you become a teacher. Like I've got the sort of second prize. I think, well, you're an idiot. You know, it's a great profession. It's a great profession.
And a very privileged role, isn't it? Because it is. Next to their parents, I mean, we're the adults that they spend the most time in.
Absolutely.
Those significant years of adolescence.
Yeah. And there was this person retiring at my school who taught there for however many years. She'd had a 34-year career, and she was talking about it, and she was head of HISI. But the way she talked about it, I can't imagine many people coming to the end of their career as in many areas and being able to talk about it as she talked about it. It was just absolutely moving, and absolutely, I felt, yeah, that is what we are about as a community. Yeah, very much so.
Hoddy, thank you for a wonderful chat.
Thank you, Peter. It's been amazing. Thank you.
Thank you, Judith, for your insight in this episode. And thank you for joining us in this episode. It's always a pleasure to have your company. I'm Peter Ayers. Keep well, keep warm, stay safe, and I'll catch you next time on Stages.